snapped the manager. "You don't need to see those antics as you enjoy your coffee, sir."
"The disruption in your winter garden," said Fiero. "That was someone trying to break down your wall into that yard and get them out alive."
"Don't even suggest it," shot the manager in a low voice. "There are more ears in this room than yours and mine. How do I know who was up to what or why? I'm a private citizen, and I mind my own business."
Fiero didn't take a replacement cup of cherry chocolate. There were racking cries from the mother bear, and then a silence in the world outside the heavy damask drapes.
"Was it an accident I saw that?" Fiero wondered, looking at the manager with new eyes.
"Or is it just that the world unwraps itself to you again and again, as soon as you are ready to see it anew?" He wanted to tell Elfie what he had seen, but he held back for reasons he couldn't name. In some way, in the balance of their affections, he sensed she needed an identity separate from his. Were he to become a convert to her cause, she might drift away. He did not dare to risk it, but the vision of the battered bear cub haunted him. He held Elfie the tighter, trying to communicate a deeper passion without speaking it. He noticed, too, that when she was agitated, she was the more liberal in her lovemaking. He began to be able to tell when she was going to say, "Not till next week." She seemed more abandoned, more salacious, perhaps as a cleansing exercise before disappearing for a few days. One morning, as he was stealing some of the cat's milk for his coffee, she rubbed some oil on her skin, wincing with sensitivity, and said over her shoulder of soft green marble, "A fortnight, my dear, my pet, as my father used to say. I need a fortnight of privacy now." He had a sudden pang, a premonition, that she was going to leave him. It was a way for her to get 2 weeks' head start.
"No," he said, "that's not on, Feifei. It's not all right. It's too long."
"We need it," she expanded. "Not you and I. I mean the other we. Obviously, I can't tell you what we're about, but the last plans for the autumn campaign are falling into place. There's going to be an episode. I can't say more, and I must be available to the network at all times."
"A coup," he said. "An assassination, a bomb, a kidnapping? What? Just the nature of it, not the specifics. What?"
"Not only can I not tell you," she said, "I don't even know. I'll be told only my small part, and I'll do it. I only know it's a complicated maneuver with a lot of interlocking pieces."
"Are you the dart?" he said. "Are you the knife, the fuse?"
She said, though he wasn't convinced, "My dearie, my puppet, I am too green to walk into a public place and do something bad. It's all too expected. Security guards watch me like owls on a mouse. My very presence provokes alarm and heightened vigilance. No, no, the part I'll play will be a handmaiden's part, a little assistance in the shadows."
"Don't do it," he said.
"You're selfish," she said, "and you're a coward. I love you, my sweet, but your protests about this are wrong-headed. You just want to preserve my insignificant life. You don't even have a moral feeling about whether I'm doing right or wrong. Not that I want you to. Not that I care what you think about it. But I only observe your objections are of the weakest sort. Now, this isn't something to be argued. 2 weeks from tonight, come back."
"Will the action be completed by then? Who decides?"
"I don't know what it is yet, and I don't even know who decides, so don't ask me."
"Fay." Suddenly, he didn't like her code name anymore. "Elphaba.
Do you really not know who is pulling the strings that make you move? How do you know you're not being manipulated by the wizard? You are a novice at this, for all your status as a tribal prince, she said. Why shouldn't I know if I was being a pawn of the wizard? I could tell when I was being manipulated by that harridan, Madame Morrible. I learned something about prevarication and straight-talking back at Crage Hall. Give me the credit for having spent some years at this, Fiero. You can't tell me for sure who is or isn't the boss. Papa didn't know the name of his unnamed god, she said, rising and rubbing oil on her stomach and between her legs, but modestly turning her back to him. It never is the who, is it? It's always the why. How do you hear? How do they tell you what to do? Look, you know I can't say. I know you can. She turned. Oil my breasts, will you? I'm not that stupidly male, Elphaba. Yes, you are, she laughed, but lovingly. Come on. It was daylight. The wind roared and even shook the floorboards. The cold sky above the glass was a rare pinkish blue. She dropped her shyness like a nightgown, and in the liquid glare of sunlight on old boards, she held up her hands, as if, in the terror of the upcoming skirmish, she had at last understood that she was beautiful, in her way. The collapse of her reticence frightened him more than anything else. He took some coconut oil and warmed it between his palms, and slid his hands like leathery velvet animals on her small responding breasts. The nipples stood, the color flushed. He was already fully dressed, but recklessly he pressed himself against her mildly resisting form. One hand slid down her back. She arched against him, moaning. But perhaps this time not from need. Still, his hand moved down onto her buttocks, felt between her cheeks, beyond, felt the place one muscle pulled in crookedly, endearingly, felt the very faintest etching of hair beginning its cross-hatch shadows, its swirl toward vortex. He worked his intelligent hand, reading the signs of her resistance. "I have four companions," she said suddenly, wrenching away an emotion soft enough not to disengage but to discourage. "Oh, heart, I have four comrades. They don't know who our cell leader is. It's all done in the dark, with a masking spell to shadow the voice and distort the features. If I knew more, the gale force could catch me and torture it out of me, don't you see?" "What is your object?" he breathed, kissing her, loosening his trousers again, as if this were the first time, his tongue tracing the twisting funnel of her ear. "Kill the wizard," she answered, looping her legs around him. "I am not the arrowhead. I am not the dart. I am just the shaft, the quiver." She cupped more oil in her hand, and as they slid and fell into the light, she made him bright and anguished with oil, took him deeper in than ever before. "Even after all this time, you could be an agent for the palace," she said later. "I'm not," he said. "I'm good." A little snow fell one week, then some more the next. The Feast of Lurleenmas drew nearer. The Unionist chapels, having appropriated and transformed the most visible parts of the old pagan beliefs, hung themselves shamelessly in green and gold, set out green candles and golden gongs and greenberry wreaths and gilded fruit. Along Merchant Row, shops outdid themselves, and the churches, in decor, with displays of fashionable clothes and useless and expensive trinkets. In display windows, papier-mâché figures evoked the good fairy queen Lurline in her winged chariot, and her assistant, the minor fairy Prinella, who strewed gift-wrapped delights from her capacious magic basket. He asked himself again and again if he was in love with Elphaba. He also asked himself why he was so late coming to this question after 2 months of a passionate affair, and if he knew what the words even meant, and if it mattered. He chose more gifts for the kids and for sulky Sarima, that well-fed malcontent, that monster. He missed her a little. His feelings for Elphaba seemed not to vie with those for Sarima, but to complement them. No two women could be more unlike. Elphaba demonstrated the proud independence of our Jiki mountain women that Sarima, married so young, had never developed. And Elphie wasn't just a different, not to say novel, provincial type. She seemed an advance on the gender. She seemed a different species sometimes. He caught himself with a mammoth erection, just remembering that last time. And he had to hide himself behind some ladies' scarves in a shop until it subsided. He bought 3, 4, 6 scarves for Sarima, who didn't wear scarves. He bought 6 scarves for Elphaba, who did. The shop girl, a dull Munchkinlander midget, who had to stand on a chair to reach the till, said over his shoulder, "Just in a minute, ma'am." He turned to make room at the counter for the other customer. "But Master Fiero!" cried Glinda. "Miss Glinda," he said, flabbergasted. "What a surprise!" "A dozen scarves," she said. "Look, Crope! Look who's here!" And there was Crope, a little jowly, though he couldn't be 25 yet, could he? Looking guiltily up from a display of feathery, plumy things. "We must have tea," said Glinda. "We must. Come now, pay the nice little lady, and off we fly." In her voluminous skirts, she rustled like a corps of ballerinas. He hadn't remembered her quite so giddy. Maybe this was married life. He slid a glance at Crope, who was rolling his eyes behind her back. "Just you put this on Sir Chuffrey's account, and this..." "And this," Glinda said, mounding things on the counter, "and have them sent along to our rooms in the Florenthwaite Club. I'll need them for dining, so have someone run over with them right now, if you would. How dear, so kind. Ta-ta. Boys, come along." She gripped Fiero with a pinching hand and steered him away. Crope followed like a lapdog. The Florenthwaite Club was only a street or two over, and they could easily have carried the purchases back themselves. Glinda capered and clattered down the grand staircase into the oak parlour, making enough noise so that every female resident looked up in a rewarding sort of disapproval. "Now you, Crope, there, so you can be mother and poor when we've ordered. And dear Fiero, you here, right next to me. That is, if you're not too married." They ordered tea. Glinda got used to him a bit and began to calm down. "But really, who would have thought it?" she said, picking up a biscuit and putting it down again about 8 times in a row. "We were the great and the good at Shiz, really. Look at you, Fiero. You're a prince, aren't you? Do we call you Your Highness? I never could. And you're still married to that little child?" "She's grown up now, and we have a family," Fiero told her warily. 3 children." "And she's here. I must meet her."
"No, she's back at our winter home in the Great Kells."
"Then you're having an affair," said Glinda, "because you look so happy. Who with? Anyone I know?"
"I'm just happy to see you," he said. And in fact he was. She looked wonderful,
She had filled out some. That wraith-like beauty had bloomed but not coarsened. She was more woman than waif, and more wife than woman. Her hair was cut short in a boyish style, very becoming, and there was a tiara-like thing in her curls. "And now you're a sorceress." "Oh, hardly," she said. "Can I even get that damn serving girl to hurry up with the scones and jam?" "I cannot. Yes, I can sign 100 greeting cards for the holiday season at one go, but it's a very minor talent, I tell you. Sorcery is vastly overrated in the popular press. Otherwise, why wouldn't the wizard just magic the hell out of his adversaries? No, I'm content to try to be a good partner for my Chuffrey. He's at the exchange today, doing financial thingies. Oh, do you know who else is in town? It's too rich. Crope, tell him."
Crope, surprised to be given an opening, choked on his mouthful of tea. Glinda rushed in.
"Nessa Rose! Can you believe it? She's at the family home over there in Lower Menapin Street, an address that's come up quite a lot in the past decade, I might add. We saw her where, Crope, where? It was the coffee emporium."
"It was the ice garden."
"No, I remember. It was the Spangletown Cabaret. Fiero, do you know, we went to see that old Silipede. Do you remember?" "No, you don't. I can see it in your face. She was the singer who was performing at the Oz Festival of Song and Sentiment, the day our glorious wizard arrived out of the sky in a balloon and orchestrated that coup. She's making yet another of her innumerable comeback tours. She's a bit camp now, but so what? It was gales of fun. And there, at a better table than we had, I might tell you, was Nessie. She was with her grandfather, or is it the great-grandfather, the eminent Throp? He must be 1,100 years old by now. I was shocked to see her until I realized she went merely to provide him an escort. She didn't think much of the music. She scowled and prayed all through the entr'acte. And the nanny was there, too. Who would have imagined it, Fiero? You're a prince, and Nessa Rose, just about installed as the next eminent Throp, and Averick, of course, the Margrave of Ten Meadows, and humble little me, married to Sir Chuffrey, holder of the most useless title and the biggest stock portfolio in the Pirtha Hills.
Glinda almost stopped for breath, but lunged on kindly.
And Crope, of course, dear Crope. Crope, tell Fiero all about yourself. He's dying to know. I can see it.
Actually, Fiero was interested, if only for a rest from the staccato chatter.
He's shy, Glinda pushed on. Shy, shy, shy. Always was.
Fiero and Crope exchanged glances and tried to keep their mouths from twitching.
He's got this so avant-garde little palace of a loft apartment on the top floor of a doctor's surgery. Could you imagine? Stunning views, the best views in the Emerald City, and at this time of year. He dabbles a bit in painting, don't you, dear? Painting, a little musical operetta set design here and there. When we were young, we thought the world revolved around shiz. You know there's real theatre here now. The wizard has made this a much more cosmopolitan city, don't you think?
It's good to see you, Fiero, said Crope. Say something about yourself fast, before it's too late.
You cad! You kid me mercilessly, sang Glinda. I'll tell him about your little affair with... Well, never mind, I'm not that mean.
There's nothing to say, Fiero said, feeling even more taciturn and vincus than he had when he first arrived in Shiz. I like my life. I lead my clan when they need it, which isn't often. My children are healthy. My wife is... well, I don't know.
Fertile, supplied Glinda.
Yes, he grinned. She's fertile, and I love her, and I'm not going to stay much longer, as I'm meeting someone for a business conference across town.
We must meet, said Glinda, suddenly plaintive, suddenly looking lonely. "Oh, Fiero, we're not old yet, but we're old enough to be old friends already, aren't we? Look, I've gushed on like a debutante who forgot to splash on her eau de demure. I'm sorry. It's just that that was such a wonderful time, even in its strangeness and sadness. And life isn't the same now. It's wonderful, but it isn't the same."
"I know," he said, "but I don't think I can meet you again. There's so little time, and I have to go back to Kiamoko. I've been away since the late summer."
"Look, we're all here, me and Chuffrey, Crope, Nesserose, you. Is Averick around? We could get him. We could get together. We could have a quiet dinner together in our rooms upstairs. I promise not to be so giddy. Please, Fiero, please, Your Highness. It would do me such an honor." She cocked her head and put a single finger to her chin elegantly, and he could tell she was struggling through the language of her class to say something real.
"If I think I can, I'll let you know, but please, you mustn't count on it," he said. "There'll be other times. I'm not usually in town so late in the season. This is an anomaly. My children are waiting." "Have you children, Glinda?"
"Chuffrey is dry as two baked walnuts," said Glinda, making Crope choke on his tea again. "Before you go, I can see you're getting ready to dash. Dear, dear Fiero, what do you hear from Elphaba?"
But he was prepared for this, and had readied his face to be blank. And he only said, "Now, that's a name I don't hear every day. Did she ever turn up? Surely Nesserose must have said."
"Nesserose says if her sister ever does turn up, she'll spit in her face," Glinda remarked. "So we must all pray that Nesserose never loses her faith, for that would mean the evaporation of such tolerance and kindness. I think she would kill Elphaba. Nessa was abandoned, rejected, left to look after her crazy father, her grandfather thingy, that brother, that nurse, that house, the staff. And you can't even say single-handedly, as she doesn't have any hands."
"I thought I saw Elphaba once," said Crope.
"Oh," said Fiero and Glinda together, and Glinda continued, "You never told me that, Crope."
"I wasn't sure," he said.
"I was on the trolley that runs along the reflecting pool by the palace. It was raining, some years ago now. And I saw a figure struggling with a big umbrella. I thought she was about to be blown away. A gust of wind blew the umbrella inside out, and the face, a greenish face, which is why I noticed, ducked down to avoid the splash of rainwater. You remember how Elphaba hated getting wet?" "She was allergic to water," Glinda opined. "I never knew how she kept herself so clean, and I her roommate."
"Oil, I think," said Fiero. They both looked at him. "That is, in the vincus," he stammered. "The elderly rub oil into their skin instead of water." "I've always assumed that's what Elfie did. I don't know. Glinda, if I were to meet up with you again, what's a good day?" She rooted in her reticule for a diary. Crope took the opportunity to lean forward and say to Fiero, "It really is good to see you, you know."
"You too," said Fiero, surprised that he meant it. "If you ever get out into the central Kells, come stay at Kiamo Ko with us. Just send word ahead, as we're only there for half a year at a time." "That's just your speed, Crope, the wild beasts of the untamed vincus," said Glinda. "I think the fashion possibilities, all those leather thongs and fringe and such, they might interest you, but I can't see you as Mr. Mountain Boy."
"No, probably not," agreed Crope,
"unless it affords fabulous cafes every four or five blocks. I don't think a landscape quite developed enough for human habitation.
Fiero shook hands with Crope, and then, remembering the rumors about poor Tibbet's deterioration, kissed him. He threw his arms around Glinda and hugged her hard. She laced her arm through his and walked him to the door.
"Do let me shake off Crope and have you back all to myself," she said in a low voice, her patter evaporating into seriousness. "I can't tell you, dear Fiero. The past seems both more mysterious and more understandable with you right here before me. I feel there are things I could yet learn. I don't want to wallow, dear boy, never that, but we go way back."
She held his hand between hers.
"Something's going on in your life. I'm not as dumb as I act. Something good and bad at the same time. Maybe I can help."
"You were always sweet," he said, and motioned to the doorman to hail a hansom cab. "How I regret that I won't meet Sir Chuffrey." He moved out the doorway, across the marble entrance pavement, and turned to tip his hat at her. In the doors, the doormen held them open to enhance his parting view, she was a calm, resigned woman, neither transparent nor ineffectual. Even, it might have been said, a woman full of grace.
"If you should see her," said Glinda lightly, "tell her I miss her still."
He didn't see Glinda again. He didn't call at the Florenthwaite Club. He didn't stroll past the Thropp family house in Lower Menapin Street, though he was sorely tempted. He didn't stop a scalper to try to get one of the tickets to Sillipede's triumphant fourth annual comeback tour. He found himself in the chapel of St. Glinda, in St. Glinda Square, from which he could sometimes hear the cloistered monks next door chanting and susurrating like a swarm of bees. When the 2 weeks had passed at last, and the city was worked up to a froth over Lurleenmas, he went to see Elphaba, half expecting she would have vanished. But there she was, stern and loving, and in the midst of making a vegetable pie for him. Her precious Malky was putting his feet in the flour and making paw prints all over the room. They talked awkwardly until Malky upset the bowl of vegetable stock, and that made them both laugh. He didn't tell her about Glinda. How could he? Elphaba had worked so hard to keep them all at bay, and now she was engaged in the major campaign of her life, the thing she had been working toward for 5 years. He did not approve of anarchy. Well, he knew he was in lazy doubt about everything. Doubt was much more energy efficient than conviction. But even after seeing the bear cub struck down, he had to keep an even, cautious relationship with the power on the throne, for the sake of his tribe. Also, Fiero didn't want to make Elfie's life harder than it was, and his selfish need to be comfortable with her surmounted his need to gossip. So he didn't tell her Nessa Rose and Nanny were in town either, or had been. For all he knew, he rationalized silently, they had already moved on. "I wonder," she said that night, as the stars peered through the crazy frost pattern on the skylight. "I wonder if you should get out of town before Lurleenmas Eve.
Is all hell going to break loose?"
"I told you, I don't know the whole picture. I can't know. I shouldn't know. But maybe some hell will break loose. Maybe it would be best for you to go."
"I'm not going, and you can't make me."
"I've been taking correspondence courses in sorcery on the side. I'll go poof and turn you into stone."
"You mean you'll make me hard?" "I'm already hard." Stop. Stop. Oh, you wicked woman, you have bewitched me again. Look, it has a mind of its own. Fiero, stop. Stop. Now look, I mean it. I want to know where you're going to be on Lerlinmas Eve. Just so I can be sure you're not going to get hurt. Tell me.
You mean we won't be together?
It's a work night for me, she said grimly. I'll see you the next day.
I'll wait here for you.
No, you won't. I think we've covered our tracks pretty well, but there's still a chance, even at this late date, that somebody could come here to intercept me. No, you stay in your club and take a bath. Take a nice long cold bath. Got it? Don't even go out. They say it might be snowy by then anyway. It's Lerlinmas Eve. I'm not going to spend the holiday in a bathtub all alone.
Well, hire some company. See if I care.
As if you don't. Just stay away from anything social. I mean theater or crowds or even restaurants, please. Will you promise me that?
If you could be more specific, I could be more careful.
You could be most careful if you left town completely.
You could be most careful if you told me.
Give over with that. Cut it out. I don't think I even want to know where you are, come to think of it. I just want you to be safe. Will you be safe? Will you stay inside, away from drunken pagan celebrations?
Can I go to chapel and pray for you?
No!
She looked so fierce that he didn't even tease her about it again.
Why should I keep myself so safe? He asked her. But he was almost asking himself, what is there in my life worth preserving? With a good wife back there in the mountains, serviceable as an old spoon, dry in the heart from having been scared of marriage since she was 6, with 3 children so shy of their father, the prince of the Arjikis, that they will hardly come near him, with a careworn clan moving here, moving there, going through the same disputes, herding the same herds, praying the same prayers as they have done for 500 years, and me, with a shallow and undirected mind, no artfulness in word or habit, no especial kindness toward the world. What is there that makes my life worth preserving?
I love you, said Elphaba.
So that's that, then.
And that's it, he answered her and himself.
And I love you.
So I promise to be careful.
Careful of us both, he thought. So he stalked her again. Love makes hunters of us all. She had swathed herself in long dark skirts, like some sort of a religious woman, and tucked up her hair inside a tall, wide-brimmed hat with a crown like a cone. There was a dark scarf, purple and gold, wound around her neck, and pulled over her mouth, though she would need more than a scarf to mask that lovely prow of a nose. She wore elegant, tight-fitting gloves, a nicer type of accessory than she usually went in for, though he feared it was to allow for nimbler control of her hands. Her feet were lost in big, steel-toed boots, like the kind worn by miners in the Glickus. If you didn't know she was green, it would be hard to tell, in this dark afternoon, in this raking skittle of snow. She didn't look behind her. Perhaps she didn't care if she was being followed. Her circuit took her around some of the major squares of the city. She ducked in for a minute to the chapel of St. Glinda next to the Monterey, the one where he had first seen her. Perhaps she was getting last-minute instructions, but she didn't try to give him or anyone else the slip. She emerged in a minute or two. Or perhaps, perish the thought, she was actually praying for guidance and strength. She crossed the Law Courts Bridge, She wandered along the Ozma embankment and cut diagonally through the abandoned rose gardens of the Royal Mall. The snow pestered her. She kept twining her cape the more tightly around. The silhouette of her thin, dark-stockinged legs in those huge comical boots showed up against the snowy blankness of the Oz Deer Park, now, of course, bereft of deer and deer. She marched, head tucked down, past the cenotaphs and obelisks and memorial tablets to the magnificent dead of this escapade or that. The decades, Fiero thought, in love with her, or at least so frightened for her that he could mistake it for love, the decades looked on and didn't notice her passing. They stared from their fixed mounts across at each other and didn't see revolution striding between them on her way to destiny. But the wizard must not be her aim. She must have told the truth in saying that she was too untried and too obvious to be selected as the wizard's assassin. She must be involved in a diversionary tactic, or in taking out a possible successor or high-level ally. For tonight, the wizard would be opening the anti-royalist revisionist exhibit of struggle and virtue at the People's Academy of Art and Mechanics near the palace. Yet at the top of the Shiz Road, Elphaba struck out sideways, away from the palace district, cutting through the small, fashionable district of Goldhaven. The homes of the filthy rich were guarded by mercenaries, and she clopped past them on the pavements, past the stable boys out sweeping the snow off the pavement with their brooms. She did not look up or down or back over her shoulder. Fiero guessed he was the more ostentatious figure, striding in his opera cape in the snow 100 paces behind. At the edge of Goldhaven was perched a small bluestone jewel of a theatre, the Lady's Mystique. In the shallow but elegant square before it, white lights and gold and green spangles hung in profusion, looped from streetlight to streetlight. Some holiday oratorio or other was scheduled. He could only read sold out on the board in front, and the doors weren't yet opened. The crowd was gathering. Some vendors sold hot chocolate in tall ceramic glasses, and a crowd of self-approving youngsters amused themselves and bothered some elderly people by singing a parody of an old unionist hymn of the season. The snow came down on all, on the lights, the theater, the crowds. It landed in the hot chocolate. It was churned to mush and ice on the bricks. Bravely, foolishly, without decision or choice, it felt like, Fiero climbed the steps of a nearby private library to keep an eye on Elphaba, who lost herself in the crowd. Was there to be a murder in the theater? Was there to be arson? The innocent Sybarites roasted like chestnuts? Was it a single mark, an appointed victim, or was it mayhem and disaster? The more, the worse, the better. He didn't know if he was there to prevent what she was about to do, or to save whomever he could from the catastrophe, or to tend anyone hurt accidentally, or even maybe just to witness it, so he could know more about her. And love her or not love her, but know which of the two it was. She was circulating through the crowd, as if trying to locate someone. He believed incredibly that she didn't know he was there. Was she so intent on finding the right victim, and he didn't fill the bill? Could she not feel her lover in the same open-air square with her as the wind moved the curtains of snow? A phalanx of gale forces appeared from an alley between the theater and a school next door. They took up their places before the bank of glass doors in front. Elphaba mounted the steps of an ancient wool market, a kind of stone gazebo. Fiero saw that she had something under her cloak. Explosives? Some magic implement? Did she have colleagues in the square? Were they lining themselves up one with another? The crowd kept getting thicker as the hour for the oratorio drew near. Inside the glass doors, house management was busy lining up stanchions and stringing velvet ropes to promote a genteel entry into the hall. Nobody pushed and shoved into a public space like the very rich Fiero knew. A carriage came around the corner of a building on the far side of the square. It couldn't come right up to the doors of the theater, as the crowds were too dense, but it proceeded as far as it was able. Sensing the presence of someone with authority, the crowd drew a little still. Could this be the elusive wizard on an unannounced visit? A coachman in a tech fur headpiece flung the door open and reached his hand in to assist the passenger in alighting. Fiero held his breath. Elphaba stiffened into petrified wood. This was the target. Out into the snowy street, in a tidal wave of black silk and silver spangles, swept a huge woman. She was magisterial and august. She was Madame Morrible, no other. Even Fiero recognized her, having met her only once. He saw that Elphaba knew that this was the one she must kill. She had known this. In an instant, all was dead clear. If she was caught and captured and tried, her motivation couldn't be more wonderful. She was merely a mad student from Madame Morrible's own Crage Hall. She carried a grudge she never forgot. It was too perfect. But could Madame Morrible be involved in intrigue with the wizard? Or was this just a diversion to take the mind of the authorities away from some more urgent target? Elphaba's cape twitched. Her hand went up and down inside it, as if priming something. Madame Morrible was growling a greeting to the crowd, which, while not necessarily knowing who she was, appreciated the spectacle, if not the bulk of her arrival. The head of Crage Hall walked four steps toward the theater, on the arm of a tick-tock minion, and Elphaba leaned a little forward from under the wool market. Her chin was now sharply jutting out from the scarf, her nose aiming forward. She looked as if she could snip Madame Morrible into shreds, just using the serrated blades of her natural features. Her hands continued to figure out things beneath the cape. But then were thrown open the front doors of the building Madame Morrible was walking past, not the theater, but the adjacent school, Madame Teastain's female seminary. Out the doors swarmed a cluster, a little upper-class mob of schoolgirls. What were they doing in school on Lerlinmas Eve? Fiero caught Elphaba looking wildly surprised. The girls were six or seven, small creamy lumps of uncurdled femininity, spooned into furry muffs, and tucked into furry scarves, and tipped into boots with furry edges. They were laughing and singing, raucous and rough, as the elite adults they would become. And in their midst was a pantomime player, someone being the fairy Prinella. It was a man, as the convention had it, a man done up in silly clown-like makeup and mock-bouncing bosom, and a wig and extravagant skirts, and a straw hat, and a huge basket with trinkets and treasures spilling out. "Ooh la! Society!" he fluted at Madame Morrible. "Even Fairy Prinella can have a present for the lucky pedestrian." For a moment, Fiero thought the man in drag was going to pull out a knife and kill Madame Morrible right in front of the children. But no. Espionage was organized, but not that organized. This was a real accident, a disruption. They hadn't figured on there being a school occasion this evening, nor on a screaming flock of schoolgirls greedily tugging at an actor in skirts and falsetto. Theero turned back to look at Elphaba. Her face struggled with disbelief. The children were in the way of whatever she was supposed to do. They were a small, unruly mob, chasing around the head, teasing Prunella, leaping up at him, her, grabbing for presents. The children were the accidental context. Noisy, innocent daughters of tycoons, despots, and butcher generals. He could see Elphaba working. He could see her hands fighting with each other, to do it anyway, to keep from doing it, whatever it was. Madame Morrible pushed on like a huge float in a Remembrance Day parade, and the doors of the theater opened for her. She passed grandly into safety. Outside, the children danced and sang in the snow. The crowd surged this way and that. Elphaba crumpled and sank back against a pillar, shivering with self-loathing so violently that Fiero could see it from 50 yards away. He began to push toward her, devil come what may, but by the time he reached the steps, she had, for the first and only time, managed to lose him. The audience filed into the theater. The children shrieked their song in the street, awash with greed and joy. The carriage that had brought Madame Morrible around was able to draw up in front of the theater and start its long wait for her to come out again. Theero paused, unsure, in case there was a backup plan, in case Elphaba had something else up her sleeve, in case the theater exploded. Then he began to worry that in the few minutes of losing sight of her, Elphaba had been rounded up by the gale force. Could they have whisked her out of sight that fast? What should he do if she became one of the disappeared? At a clip, he headed back across town. Mercifully, he found a waiting cab, and he had the cab drive him directly to the street of warehouses adjacent to the military garrison in the city's 9th district. In a state of profound agitation, he arrived back at Elphaba's little airy atop the corn exchange. As he climbed the stairs, his bowels turned suddenly to water, and it was only with effort that he managed to make it to the chamber pot. His inside slopped noisily, wetly out, and he held his perspiring face in his hand. The cat was perched atop the wardrobe, glaring down at him. Voided, washed down, and at least loosely done up again, he tried to coax Malky with a bowl of milk. She would have none of it. He found a couple of dried crackers and ate them miserably, and then pulled on the chain to open the skylight to help air the room. A couple of plops of snow fell in and sat there, not melting. It was that cold in the damn place. He went to build up a fire, pulled open the iron door of the stove. The fire caught, then flared, and the shadows detached themselves and moved as shadows will. But these shadows moved fast, across the room, at him, before he could register what they were. Except that there were 3 or 4 or 5, and they were wearing black clothes and black char on their faces, and their heads were wrapped in colored scarves like the ones he had bought for Elphaba, for Sarima. On the shoulder of one, he saw the glint of a gilded epaulet, a senior member of the Gale Force. There was a club, and it beat down on him like the kick of a horse, like the falling limb of a tree hit by lightning. There must be pain, but he was too surprised to notice. That must be his blood, squirting a ruby stain on the white cat, making it flinch. He saw its eyes open, twin golden green moons, befitting of the season, and the cat then scarpered through the open skylight and was lost in the snowy night. The youngest Mont was obliged to answer the convent door if the bell sounded during mealtime. In fact, she was clearing away the remains of pumpkin soup and rye brisks, the other Monts already wafting in a cerebral mood toward their cloister chapel upstairs. She hesitated before deciding to answer the bell. In another 3 minutes, she too would have been losing herself in devotions, and the bell would have gone unheeded. She had rather get the dishes to soak, frankly, but the seasonal cheer bullied her into charity. She opened the huge door to find a figure crouched like a monkey in the dark corner of the stone porch. Beyond, snow was wrinkling the façade of the adjacent church of St. Glinda, making it look like a reflection in water, only right way up. The streets were empty, and a noise of choirs came filtering out of the candlelit church. "What is it?" said the novice, remembering then to add, "Good Lurlinmus, my friend?" She decided, once she saw the blood on the odd green wrists and the darting look in the eyes, that holiday decency required her to drag the creature inside. But she could hear her sister Monts assembling in their private chapel, and the mother Mont beginning to sing a prelude in her silvery contralto. This was the novice's first big liturgical event as a member of this community, and she didn't want to miss a moment of it. "Come with me, Dolly," she said, and the creature, a young woman a year or two older than she was, managed to straighten up enough to walk or hobble like a cripple, like a person so malnourished that their extensors cannot flex and their limbs look as if they are about to snap. The novice stopped in a washroom to rinse the blood off the wrists and to make certain that it was indeed splattered mess from the beheading of some hen for a holiday supper, and not a sad attempt at suicide. But the stranger recoiled from the sight of water, and looked so deranged and unhappy that the novice stopped. She used a dry towel instead. The Monts were beginning antiphonal chants upstairs. How maddening! The novice took the path of least resistance. She dragged the forlorn thing down toward the winter salon, where the old retired biddies lived out their lives in a haze of amnesia, and the discreetly placed clumps of marginium plants, whose sweet miasma helped mask the odors of the old and incontinent. The crones lived in a time of their own. They couldn't be carted upstairs to the sacred chapel anyway. "Look, I'll sit you down here," she said to the woman. "I don't know if you need sanctuary or food or a bath or forgiveness, whatever, but you can stop here warm and dry and safe and quiet. I'll come back to you after midnight. It's the feast day, you see. It's the vigil service. Watch and wait and hope." She pushed the hunted, haunted woman into a soft chair and found a blanket. Most of the crones were snoring away, their heads nodding on their breastbones, dribbling softly onto bibs ornamented with green and gold berries and leaves. A few were telling their beads. The courtyard, open in summer, was now walled in with glass panels for the winter. So it looked like a square fish tank in an aquarium. Snow falling in it always made them peaceful. "Look, you can see the snow, white as the grace of the unnamed god," said the novice, remembering her pastoral requirements. "Think on that, and rest and sleep. Here's a pillow. Here's a stool for your feet. Upstairs we'll be singing and praising the unnamed god. I'll pray for you." "Don't," said the green ghostly guest, then slumped her head against the pillow. "It's my pleasure to," said the novice, a bit aggressively, and fled just in time to catch the processional hymn. For a while the winter salon was still. It was like a fishbowl into which a new acquisition has been dropped. The snow moved as if done by a machine, gently and mesmerizingly, with a soft churr. The blossoms of the marginium plants closed a bit in the strengthening cold of the room. Oil lamps issued their funereal crepe ribbons into the air. On the other side of the garden, hardly visible through the snow and the two windows, a decrepit Mont, with a more precise grasp of the calendar than her sister's, began to hum a saucy old pagan hymn to Lurline. Up to the shivering figure of the newcomer came one of the elders, inching forward in a wheeled chair. She leaned forward and sniffed. From a cloak of plaid blanket, blue and ivory, she pawed her old hands along the armrests. She reached out and touched Elphaba's hand.
"Well, the poor dolly is sick. The poor dolly is tired," said the ancient thing.
Her hands felt, as the novices had done, for open wounds on the wrists. Nothing.
"Though intact, the poor dolly is in pain," she said, as if approving.
A dome of near-balding scalp came into view under the hood of the blanket.
"The poor dolly is faint. The poor dolly is faltering," she went on.
She rocked a bit and pressed Elphaba's hands between her own, as if to warm them, but it was doubtful that her anemic and incompetent old circulatory system could heat a stranger when it could scarcely heat herself. Still she kept on.
"The poor poppet is failure itself," she murmured. "Happy holidays to one and all. Come, my dear, lay your breast on old mother's bosom. Old Mother Mont will set things right."
She couldn't quite pull Elphaba out of her position of dreamless, sleepless grief. She could only keep Elphaba's hands tightly clutched within her own, as a sepal sockets the furls of young petal.
"Come, my precious, and all will be well. Rest in the bosom of mad Mother Yackel. Mother Yackel will see you home."
Part 4. In the Vincus. The Voyage Out. On the day the seven-year Mont was to leave, Sister Bursar took the huge iron key from her bosom and unlocked the store chamber and said, "Come in." She pulled from the press 3 black shifts, 6 camisoles, gloves, and a shawl. She also handed over the broom. Finally, for emergencies, a basket of simples, herbs and roots, tinctures, rues, salves, and balms. There was paper, too, though not much, 12 pages or so, in different shapes and thicknesses. Paper was in ever shorter supply in all of Oz.
"Make it last, make it important," advised Sister Bursar. "You're a bright one, for all your sulks and silences."
She found a pen, a phoenix feather, known for the endurance and strength of the quill. 3 pots of black ink, sealed under knobby wrist holds of wax. Otsi Manglehand was waiting in the ambulatory with the old Superior Mont. The convent was paying a decent penny for this service, and Otsi needed the fees. But she didn't like the look of the sullen Mont that Sister Bursar ushered in.
"This is your passenger," said the Superior Mont. "Her name is Sister St. Elphaba. She's spent many years in solitary life and in nursing. The habit of gossip is lost, but it's time for her to move on, and move on she will. You'll find her no trouble."
Otsi looked the passenger over and said, "The grass trail train doesn't promise the survival of its party, Mother.
I've led 24 trips these past 10 years or so, and there have been more casualties than I like to admit."
"She leaves of her own free will," said the Superior Mont. "Should she wish to return at any point, we would take her in. She is one of us."
She didn't look one of anything to Otsi, neither flesh nor fowl, neither idiot nor intellectual. Sister St. Aelphaba just stared at the floor. Though she seemed to be about 30, she had a sallow, adolescent look about her.
"And there's the luggage. You can manage it?" The Superior Mont pointed to the small heap of supplies in the immaculate forecourt in front of the Montery.
Then she turned to the departing Mont.
"Sweet child of the unnamed god," said the Superior Mont, "you go from us to conduct an exercise in expiation. You feel there is a penalty to pay before you may find peace. The unquestioning silence of the cloister is no longer what you need. You are returning to yourself. So we send you from us with our love and with our expectations of your success. Godspeed, my good sister."
The passenger kept her eyes trained on the ground and did not answer. The Superior Mont sighed.
"We must be off to our devotions."
She peeled a few notes from a roll of money kept in the recesses of her veils and handed them over to Otsi Manglehand.
"This should see you through, and more besides."
It was a healthy amount. Otsi stood to earn a lot from escorting this taciturn woman through the Kells, more than from the whole rest of her party combined.
"You are too good, Mother Mont," she said.
She took the cash with her strong hand and made a gesture of deference with her limp one.
"No one is too good," said the Superior Mont, but nicely,
and retired with surprising speed behind the cloister doors. Sister Bursar said, "You're on your own now, Sister Elfie, and may all the stars smile you on your way." And she disappeared as well. Otsi went to load the luggage and supplies in the wagon. There was a small, chunky ragamuffin boy asleep behind the trunk.
"Off with you," said Otsi.
But the boy muttered, "I'm to go too. That's what they told me." When Sister St. Aelphaba neither confirmed nor denied this plan, Otsi began to understand why the payment to take the green mont away had been more than generous. The cloister of St. Glinda was located in the Shale Shallows, 12 miles southwest of the Emerald City. It was an outpost montuary, under the aegis of the one in town. Sister St. Aelphaba had spent 2 years in town and 5 years here, according to the Mother Mont.
"You want to be called Sister still, now that you're sprung from that holy prison?" asked Otsi as she clucked the reins and urged the pack horses on.
"Elfie is fine," said the passenger.
"And the boy? What's he called?"
Elfie shrugged.
The coach met the rest of the caravan a few miles on. There were 4 wagons in all, and 15 travelers. Elfie and the boy were the last to join. Otsi Manglehand outlined the proposed route. South along the edge of Kellswater, west through Cumbrecia's Pass, northwest through the thousand-year grasslands, stopping at Kiamo Ko, and then wintering a bit farther northwest. The Vincus was uncivilized land, Otsi told them, and there were tribal groups to be wary of. The Unamata, the Skrow, the Arjiki. And there were animals and spirits. They would need to stick together. They would need to trust one another. Elfie showed no sign of listening. She fiddled with the fennec's feather and drew patterns in the soil between her feet, coiling shapes like dragons writhing or smoke rising.
The boy squatted 8 or 10 feet away, wary and shuttered. He seemed to be her page, for he managed her bags and attended her needs, but they did not look at each other or speak. Otsi found it strange in the extreme, and hoped it didn't augur ill. The grass-trail train set off at sunset, and made only a few miles before its first camp at a stream bed. The party, mostly Gilliconese, chattered in nervous amazement at their courage to go so far afield from the safety of central Oz. All for different reasons, for business, for family needs, to pay a debt, to kill an enemy. The Vincas was a frontier, and the Winkies a benighted, bloodthirsty folk who knew little about indoor plumbing or the rules of etiquette, so the party regaled itself in song. Otsi took part for a short time, but she knew there was hardly one among them who wouldn't prefer to stay where they were and avoid the depths of the Vincas altogether. Except perhaps that Elfie, who was keeping pretty much to herself. They left the rich edge of Gilliken behind. The Vincas began with a mesh of pebbles spread on brown wet soil. At night, the lizard star pointed the direction. South, south along the edge of the Great Kells, to the dangerous gap of Cambrisia's Pass. Pines and black star saps stood up like teeth on every embankment. By day they were welcoming, sometimes giving shade. By night they towered and harbored snatch owls and bats. Elfie was often awake at night. Thought was returning to her, perhaps expanding under the fierce openness, where the birds cried in falling voices, and the meteors stitched omens into the sky. Sometimes she tried to write with her fennec's feather. Sometimes she sat and thought words out, and didn't commit them to paper. Life outside the cloister seemed to cloud up with such particularity. The shape of her 7 years past was already being crowded out. All that undifferentiated time, washing terracotta floors without dipping her hands in the bucket. It took hours to do a single room, but no floor was ever cleaner. Making wine, taking in the sick, working in the infirmary wing, which had reminded her briefly of Craige Hall. The benefit of a uniform was that one need not struggle to be unique. How many uniquenesses could the unnamed god or nature create? One could sink selflessly into the daily pattern. One could find one's way without groping. The little changes, the red bird landing on the windowsill, and that was spring, the leaves to rake from the terrace, and that was fall, they were enough. 3 years of absolute silence, 2 years of whisper, and then, moved up and outward by the decision of the Superior Mont, 2 years on the ward for incurables. There, for 9 months, thought Elfie under the stars, picturing it to herself as if telling someone else, she tended the dying, and those too clumsy to die. She grew to see dying as a pattern, beautiful in its way. A human form is like a leaf. It dies in a set piece, unless something interferes. First this, then that, then this. She might have gone on as a nurse forever, arranging wrists in a pleasing pattern above starched bedsheets, reading the nonsense words of scripture that seemed to help so. She could manage the dying. Then, a year ago, pale invalid Tibbet was carted to the home for the incurables. He wasn't too far gone to recognize her, even behind her veil and silences. Weak, unable to shit or piss without help, his skin falling in rags and parchment, he was better at life than she was. He selfishly required that she be an individual, and he addressed her by her name. He joked. He remembered stories. He criticized old friends for abandoning him. He noticed the differences in how she moved from day to day, how she thought. He reminded her that she did think. Under the scrutiny of his tired frame, she was recreated, against her will, as an individual, or nearly. At last he died, and the Superior Mont had said that it was time for her to go and atone for her mistakes, though not even the Superior Mont knew what they were. When that was done, well, she was still a young woman. She could raise a family. Take her broom and remember, obedience and mystery.
"You can't sleep," said Otzi one night, as Elfie sat under the stars.
But though her thoughts were rich and complicated, her words were poor, and she merely grunted. Otzi made a few jokes at which Elfie tried to smile, but Otzi laughed enough for both of them, big, full laughs. It made Elfie tired.
"Isn't that cook a piece of work?" said Otzi,
and told some episode that seemed pointless, and she chortled at her own story. Elfie tried to enjoy, tried to grin, but above her the stars grew thicker, more like glittering fish spawn than salt. They turned on their stalks with a cursing, grinding sound. If only she could hear it. She couldn't hear it. Otzi was too coarse and loud. There was much to hate in this world, and too much to love. Before long they came to the edge of Kellswater, a murderous slice of water lying as if cleft from the side of a thundercloud. It was all grey, no lights on it.
"That," said Otzi, "is why the horses don't drink from it, nor travellers. That's why it was never tapped in aqueducts and run to the Emerald City. It's dead water. And you thought you'd seen it all."
Still, the travellers were impressed. A lavender heaviness arose on its western edge, the first hint of the Great Kells, the mountains that separated the Vincas from the rest of Oz. From here the mountains appeared as thin as gas. Otzi demonstrated the use of the fog charm in the event of an attack by a band of Unimata hunters.
"Are we going to be attacked?" asked the boy, who seemed to be Elfie's page. "I'll get him dead before no one knows what's on."
The fear rose up from him and caught on in the others.
"We usually do well," said Otzi. "We just need to be prepared. They can be friends, if we are friends."
The caravan straggled by day, four wagons keeping their distance, accompanied by 9 horses, 2 cows, a bull, a heifer, and various chickens, without much personality. The cook had a dog named Killyjoy, who seemed to Elfie a Makejoy instead, a panting, sniffy thing. Some people thought for a time he might actually be a dog in hiding, but they gave up that idea.
"Ha!" Elfie said to the others. "Have you spoken to animals so seldom that you can't remember the difference any more?"
No, he was just a dog, but a most glorious doggy dog, full of rages and exaggerated devotions. Killyjoy was a mountain breed, part Leinster Collie, part Lynx Terrier, and maybe part wolf. His nose went up like a butter curl in grey-black ridges and ribs. He could not be kept from hunting, but he did not catch much either. By night, when the wagons squared off together, the cooking fire within, the animals just nearby without, and the singing began at last, Killyjoy hid under the wagon. Otzi heard the boy tell the dog his name.
"I'm Lear," said the boy. "You can be my dog, sort of."
She had to smile. The fat child was not good at making friends, and a lonely child should have a dog. Kellswater slipped back out of sight. Some felt safer away from it. Almost hourly the great kells rose and thickened, the color now like the brown rind of a butterdew melon. Still the track meandered along the valley, the Vincus River on its right, the mountains beyond it. Otsi knew several places to ford, but they weren't clearly marked. While they searched, Killyjoy caught a valley grite at last. He bled and whined and was treated for poison. Lear let him ride in his arms, which made Elfie faintly jealous. She was almost amused to note in herself such a turgid, old-fashioned feeling as jealousy. The cook was angry that Killyjoy preferred someone else's company more than his. He shook his ladle overhead as if summoning the wrath of angel chefs among the stars. Elfie thought of him as a butcher cook, as he seemed to have no scruples about shooting rabbits and eating them. "How do you know they're not rabbits?" she said, and she wouldn't touch a bite. "Quiet, you, or I'll cook that little boy instead," he answered. She tried to raise with Otsi the notion of firing the cook, but Otsi would not listen. "We're coming in to Cambricia's Pass," she said. "My mind is on other matters." They couldn't help but feel the unsettling eroticism of the landscape. From the eastern approach, the Cambricia Pass looked like a woman lying on her back, her legs spread apart, welcoming them. Up in the slopes, the pine boughs shaded the sun. The wild pears tangled their twisted branches together as if wrestling. A sudden dampness, a new private climate. The bark ran wet, the air sank heavily against the skin like half-laundered toweling. Once inside the forest, the travelers could not see the hills. Everything smelled of ferns and fiddle greens. And on the shores of a small lake stood a dead tree. It harbored a community of bees at their work of chamber music and honey. "I want to take them with us," said Elfie. "I'll talk to them and see if they'll come." There had been bees in the kitchen garden at Craige Hall, and again at the cloister of St. Glinda in the Shale Shallows. Elfie was entranced by them. But Lear was terrified, and the cook threatened to disappear and leave the group traumatized by an inability to do a really top-notch bechamel sauce in the wilderness. Discussion was waged. An old man in the party, heading westward to die because of some midnight vision, ventured as to how a little honey would improve the tasteless sparrow-leaf tea. A Glickan mail-order bride agreed. Otsi, of sentimental enthusiasms, when least expected, voted for honey. So Elfie climbed the tree and talked to the bees, and they came along in a swarm, but most travelers stayed in the other wagons, suddenly scared of every fleck of dust that flitted against the skin. They sent out a request, using drums and mist, to attract the attention of a hired Rafiki, for caravans were not allowed to move through the lands of different Vincus tribes without a guide to negotiate permissions and fees. Bored one evening, and responding to the gloom, the travelers fell to discussing the legend of the Cumbric Witch. Who comes first, the Fairy Queen Lurline or the Cumbric Witch? Igo, the sick old man, quoted the Ossiad, and reminded them all of how creation worked. The Dragon of Time created the sun and the moon, and Lurline cursed them and said that their children wouldn't know their own parents. And then the Cumbric Witch came along, and the flood, the battle, the spilling of evil in the world. Otsi Mangalhan disagreed. She said, "You old fools! The Ossiad is just a frilly romantic poem of older, harsher legends. What lives in folk memory is truer than how some artsy poet says it. In folk memory, evil always predates good." "Can this be true?" asked Igo with interest.
Surely there is the handful of nursery merchant that start, "Once in the middle of a forest lived an old witch," or "The devil was out walking one day and met a child," said Otsi, who was showing that she had some education as well as grit. To the grim poor there need be no pourquoi tale about where evil arises. It just arises. It always is. One never learns how the witch became wicked, or whether that was the right choice for her. Is it ever the right choice? Does the devil ever struggle to be good again? Or, if so, is he not a devil? It is at the very least a question of definitions.
It certainly is true that tales of the Cumbric witch abound, agreed Igo. Every other witch is just a shadow, a daughter, a sister, a decadent descendant. The Cumbric witch is the model further back than which it seems impossible to go.
Elfie remembered the ambiguous scroll painting of the Cumbric witch. Was it she? Found in the library of Three Queens that summer long ago, standing in shiny shoes, straddling a continent, nursing or choking a beast.
"I don't believe in the Cumbric witch, even in Cumbricia's Pass," boasted the cook.
"You don't believe in rabbits either," snarled Elfie, suddenly annoyed. "The question is, does the Cumbric witch believe in you?"
"Temper," sang out Otsi, and turned it into a sing-along song. Elfie stamped away. This was too much like her childhood, discussions with her father and Nessa Rose about where evil begins. As if one could ever know. Her father used to orchestrate proofs about evil as a way of persuading his flock to convert. Elfie had come to think, back in Shiz, that as women wore cologne, men wore proofs to secure their own sense of themselves and thus to be attractive. But surely evil was beyond proof, just as the Cumbric witch was beyond the grasp of knowable history. The Rafiki arrived, a thin, balding man with battle scars. There might be trouble from the Unamata this year, he told them.
"The caravan comes after a season of dirty forays by cavalry from the Emerald City. Winky roundup," he complained.
It wasn't clear if he was talking about a local argument over a drunken slight to a Vincus maiden, or about a slave trade and resettlement camps. The camp was broken, the lake left behind, and the silent forest continued for a half a day. Sunlight speared through the canopy from time to time, but it was a thin egg-yolk light, and seemed always to be off to the side, never spotlighting down on the path ahead. It was eerie, as if Cumbricia herself were moving along beside them, hidden, unbidden, passing from tree to tree, sliding behind rocks, waiting in shadowy depths, watching and listening. The ailing old man wailed nasally and prayed to emerge from this mystery wood before he died, or his spirit might never find its way out. The boy wept like a girl. The cook wrung the neck of a chicken. Even the bees stopped humming. In the middle of the night, the cook disappeared. There was consternation among all except Elfie, who didn't care. Was it a kidnapping, or a sleepwalking episode, or a suicide? Were the angry Unamata near and watching? Was it Cumbricia herself taking revenge on them for discussing her so glibly? There were many opinions, and the breakfast eggs were runny and inedible. Killyjoy did not notice the cook's disappearance. He snuggled, grinning in his coma sleep, closer to Lear. The bees went into some sort of mysterious hibernation inside the joint of tree trunk brought along to make them happy. Killyjoy, still smarting from grite poison, slept 22 hours a day. The travelers, afraid of being overheard, stopped talking altogether. Toward the evening the pines at last began to thin, and the forest to shift to Staghead Oak, which with its broader branches let in more of the sky. A pasty yellow sky, but at last a sky, and then there was a cliff edge. They had climbed higher than anyone had quite realized. Beneath and beyond stretched the rest of Cambrisia's pass, a journey of 4 or 5 days. Beyond that was the beginning of the thousand-year grasslands. No one was sorry for the light and room that the sky afforded. Even Elfie felt her heart lift unexpectedly. In the middle of the night, the Unimata arrived. They brought gifts of dried fruit and sang tribal songs, and made those who would dance get up and dance. The travelers were more terrified of their hospitality than of the attack that they had expected. As Elfie thought about it, the Unimata seemed soft, compliant folk, only as fearful and fearless as schoolgirls. At least that was all they showed. They were cavorting, opinionated. They reminded her of the Quadlings with whom she had grown up. Perhaps ethnically they were distant cousins. Long lashes, narrow elbows, baby-like supple wrists, oblong heads and thin, concentrated lips. Even with their foreign tongue they made her feel at home. The Unimata left in the morning, complaining rudely about the runniness of the breakfast eggs. The Rafiki said that the Unimata would make no further trouble. Even he seemed disappointed, as if his employment hadn't been required. There was no word about the cook. The Unimata didn't seem to know anything about him. As the caravan continued its descent, the sky opened up again, brisk and autumnal, wide as remorse. From there to there, the eye could hardly take it in. The plain below, compared to the mountains, seemed level as a lake. The wind made strokes across it, as if spelling things in a language of curls and stripes. No wildlife was visible from this distance, though there were tribal fires here and there. Cambrisia's pass was left behind, or nearly. Then a Unimata messenger came on swift leathery feet, arriving from the pass behind them, to share the news that a body had been found at the base of a cliff. Perhaps it was the cook. It was thought to be a man, but the surface of the corpse was so swollen with lesions that the particulars were lost. "It was the bees," said someone, full of rage. "Oh, was it?" came Elfie's calm voice. "They've been asleep for so long. Wouldn't there have been screams if they'd attacked a man in the middle of the night? Did the bees sting his throat first to swell his vocal cords shut? Very talented bees, those." "It was the bees," was the mutter. And the implication was clear. "You, too." "Oh, I forgot the size of the human imagination," Elfie said meanly. "How very large it is, after all." But she wasn't upset, not really. For Killyjoy was back to himself at last, and the bees woke up, too. Perhaps the high altitudes at the top of the Cambrisia Pass had given them such sleep. Elfie began to prefer their company to the rest of the travelers. As they woke up, coming down from the heights, she felt herself more and more awake, too. The Rafiki pointed out on the horizon several mounding coils of smoke. At first, the travelers guessed they were windstorms, but Otsi soothed them and alarmed them. It was evening fires for a large encampment, Skro. It was autumn hunting season, though nothing had been seen of any game bigger than a hare or a grass fox. Its brush, a wild swipe of bronze on melting golden meadow. Its feet in black stockings, like a serving maid's. Killyjoy was ecstatic with the possibilities of encounter. He could hardly bear to rest at night. Even in his dreams, he twitched with the hunt. The travelers feared the Skrow more than they had the Unimata. The Rafiki did not say much to allay their fears. He was more tentative than it at first seemed. Perhaps the job of negotiating among suspicious peoples required caution. Lear idolized him hopelessly after only a few days of travel. Elfie thought, such silly things, children, and so embarrassing, because they keep changing themselves out of shame, out of a need to be loved or something, while animals are born who they are, accept it, and that is that. They live with greater peace than people do. She felt in herself a jolt of pleasurable expectation over the thought of approaching the Skrow. Along with so much else, she had forgotten what pleasurable expectation was. As night fell, everyone seemed more alert, out of fear and excitement. The skies throbbed with turquoise, even at midnight. Starlight and comet tails burned the tips of endless grass below into a hammered silver. Like thousands of tapers in the chapel, just blown out but still glowing. If one could drown in the grass, thought Elfie, it might be the best way to die. It was noon when the caravan pulled up to the edge of the Skrow camp. A committee of Skrow had ridden to their domestic margin, where the sand-colored tents petered out into untrampled grass. Men and women alike sat on horseback, about 7 or 8 of them, in blue ribbons and ivory bangles. Also, obviously senior, was a huge slab of an old woman, carried on a palanquin of some sort, its frame all hung round with tambours and clinking amulets and gauzy veils. She let the Rafiki and the tribal paladins trade compliments or insults. After a while she grunted a direction, and her curtains were withdrawn so she could see. She had an overhung lip so large that it doubled back on itself like an upside-down spout on a pitcher. Her eyes were ringed with coal. On her shoulders sat 2 dyspeptic-looking crows. Their feet were shackled in gold links and attached to loops in her ornamental collar, into which the old woman had dribbled traces of the fruit she had been eating as she waited. Her shoulders were speckled with crow droppings.
"The Princess Nastoya," said the Rafiki at last.
She was the filthiest, least educated princess anyone had ever seen. Yet she had some dignity. Even the most ardent democrat among the travelers genuflected. She laughed raucously. Then she bade her bearers lug her away to some place less tedious. The Skrow camp was arranged in concentric circles, with the princess's tent in the middle, prettied up with extensions of faded, striped baldachins on all sides. It was a little airy palace in silks and cotton muslin. Her advisers and concubine husbands seemed to live in the nearest circle. And a scrawny lot the husbands were, thought Elfie, but perhaps they were chosen for timidity and scrawniness, to make her seem ever the larger. Beyond the princess's settlement ranged 400 tents, which meant maybe 1,000 people altogether. 1,000 humans, with their poached salmon skin, their moistly protruding eyes, but sensitive in lowered gazes to avoid being met, their handsome, generous noses and big buttocks, and wide rolling hips, men and women alike. Most of the caravan travelers stayed glued to the doors of their wagons, imagining crime just beyond the nearest tent. But Elfie found it impossible to keep still with all this newness beckoning. When Elfie walked, there were gasps, and the adults shyly retreated out of her path. But only 10 minutes had passed before there were 60 children in a noisy crowd following behind, running ahead like a cloud of midges. The Rafiki advised caution, advised return to the camp, but childhood in the Quadling Badlands had made Elphaba not only bold, but curious. There were more ways to live than the ones given by one's superiors. After the evening meal, a delegation of erect old Scrode dignitaries approached the grass trail train and entered into a lengthy palaver with the Rafiki. In the end, the Rafiki translated the message. A small band was invited, requested, ordered, to the Scrow Shrine. It would take an hour by camel. For her sin of skin color, presumably, or possibly for having had the nerve to take a solitary stroll through the Scrow tent city, Elfie was to join Otsi, the Rafiki, Igo for his venerable age, and one of the financial adventurers named Pinchweed, or maybe that was just a nasty nickname. By the light of sallowwood torches, the camels in glittering caparisons lurched and lumbered on a worn track. It was like going up and down a staircase at the same time. Elfie sat above the grass, a vantage point over the great flickering surface. Although the ocean was only an idea sprung out of mythology, she could almost see where it came from. There were small grasshawks launching themselves like fish, leaping out of the spume, nipping at the fireflies, pocketing them, then falling back in a dry splash. Bats passed, making a guttering, sputtering sound that ended in an extinguishing swoop. The plain itself seemed to bring forth night color, now a heliotrope, now a bronzy green, now a dun color skeined through with red and silver. The moon rose, an opalescent goddess tipping light from her harsh maternal scimitar. Nothing more need have happened. It seemed enough to Elphaba to find herself capable of such a weird, ecstatic response to soft color and safe space. But no, on, on. Eventually, Elfie noticed a plantation of trees, carefully tended in this devastating openness. First a stand of scrub spruce, contorted by the winds into gnarled figures of split bark and hissing needles, and the pagan odor of sap. Beyond, a rise of higher hedges, then yet higher trees. It was the circular pattern of the Scrow encampment again. The party passed into it in silence, as through a maze, along curving corridors of whispering brush, moving from outer to